The problem for Australia in all of this is that we have glued ourselves to the hip of the United States and defined our security interest, our national interest, as being exactly the same as those of the United States when it comes to China. And I think most people in the world find this quite bizarre because, well, we live in the region for a start. It's our place. China is by far our biggest trading partner, and we depend more on China for trade and our commercial well-being than any member of AUKUS and any member of the Quad.
And one for Mum, one for Dad, and one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian.
Budgets are about choices, Fran, and you show what you value through the choices you make.
Dead, buried, cremated.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
The treasurer.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
How good is Australia?
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute, and today we're going to talk about AUKUS, the security pact between Australia, the United Kingdom, and the USA. The announcement is now a few weeks old, but the diplomatic, political, and security implications will be debated for many years to come.
Diplomatic spat over Australia's nuclear submarine pact with America and Britain is intensifying.
The Prime Minister's trip to Jakarta has been cancelled in the fallout over the AUKUS defence pact.
Diplomatic slap over the submarine spat. France withdraws its diplomats
after Australia's abrupt foreign policy change, partnering with America and Britain to go nuclear.
A new deal with Washington and London, known as AUKUS.
The deal will deliver nuclear-powered submarines to the Australian Navy to promote stability in the Indo-Pacific region, which has come under increasing pressure from China.
China's official media, the voice piece of the Communist Party leadership, has gone into meltdown. Australia has turned itself into an adversary of China. It should prepare for the worst.
China says Australia will be punished without mercy for choosing America's side.
Just doing what we need to do to keep Australians safe and protect our national interests. I mean, China do the same thing.
And so I'm delighted to introduce our guest today, Dr. Jeff Raby, who was Australia's ambassador to China from 2007 to 2011. Prior to that, he was the Deputy Secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade from 2002 to 06, and he held a number of senior positions in DFAT. After 27 years in the public service, he completed his ambassadorial term and resigned to establish Jeff Raby & Associates in 2011. And joining him today is Alan Beam, Director of the International and Security Affairs Program at the Australia Institute. And Alan, too, has long experience in international policy, national security policy, and defence policy. G'day, Jeff and Alan. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Ebony.
Good afternoon, Ebony.
Jeff, I'll begin with you. As a former ambassador to China and a veteran, obviously, of foreign affairs and trade, what was your initial assessment of the AUKUS Pact when it was announced?
Well, total surprise. I did a interview on the radio almost immediately afterwards, and I said, we Australia, in terms of our security, have paid a very high price for a headline, because we still don't know what the real substance of it is. It's a complete break with the direction of Australian foreign policy over the past 30 years or longer, which was for us to find our security in Asia, not from Asia. And it is a remarkably anachronistic development where we embrace what I call the Anglosphere minus. I mean, we couldn't even whistle up the full Anglosphere. And we know why the UK is in this, because the Johnson government post-Brexit are desperately looking to find a place in the world. This notion of global Britain could be a positive thing, but if it leads to stunts like this, it could well be very damaging.
Mm. And I guess just as a follow-up to that, it was pretty evident that China was not a fan of AUKUS, but to what extent do you think that AUKUS, or indeed the Quad for that matter, are artifacts of China's rather aggressive, as it's seen here in Australia certainly, and sometimes strident responses to some of Australia's perceived misdeeds?
Yeah, well, a couple of points here. I think need to unpack AUKUS from the Quad. and treat these as quite different entities, but deriving from a common concern, and that is the rise of China and how to accommodate China in the new order. And you're absolutely right. China, as it has become stronger, bigger, its foreign policy has become more assertive, abrasive, even at times aggressive. And China itself has to learn how to live in this new order and be a welcome leader of the order to some extent, not to be seen as a disruptor. Having said that, there's, I think, a lot of myth around China as a revisionist power. China is actually investing very heavily in the multilateral system, in elements of global rules. Clearly, if you look at the WTO, China is a very positive force in the WTO, unlike the United States, which is the revisionist power when it comes to global trade rules. So, you know, there's a lot of false assumptions and false images and ideology put around. But that's the China side of this. Clearly, both AUKUS and the Quad are driven by US's concern how to maintain its dominant role in the new multipolar order. And the problem for Australia in all of this is that we have glued ourselves to the hip of the United States and defined our security interest, our national interest, as being exactly the same as those of the United States when it comes to China. And I think most people in the world find this quite bizarre because, well, we live in the region for a start. It's our place where we reside, where security in the region and stability in the region has an immediate and direct impact on Australia's interest. But of course, China is by far our biggest trading partner, and we depend more on China for trade and our commercial well-being than any member of AUKUS and any member of the Quad.
Mm.
So, you know, it is strange for Australia to toss its lot in so comprehensively with groups of countries that actually do not share our interests.
Mm.
And look, I'll make another point on this also, let's say, with respect to the Quad. Whilst clearly its genesis was to push back on China, all members of the Quad maintain, you know, quite normal relationships with China. Even India, which has currently a fairly hot border dispute in Ladakh. We alone have no formal contacts or relations with Chinese leadership or Chinese officials. So we've been through a week or two where President Biden spoke to President Xi. President Xi's picked up the phone and congratulated the new Japanese Prime Minister, where there's ongoing, continuous, normal diplomatic exchange and contact, but we have none. And all we do is pull a stunt like get involved with AUKUS.
Mm. Alan, I did want to ask you about the submarine announcement in a little bit, but picking up on what Jeff said there, what precisely are the British and the Americans and Australia looking for out of AUKUS? Because it wasn't necessarily clear to me from the announcement.
I think this is one of the big problems with this kind of stunt, as Jeff rightly calls it, that the three parties are actually all looking for quite different things. Australia is, as ever, looking for somebody to guarantee its long-term security. And it thinks that it's going to get that guarantee by acquiring nuclear-powered submarines from either Britain or the United States, but we don't know from which country at this point. We don't know how. We don't know what they're going to look like, whether they're going to be the older types of Astute or Virginia class, whether they're going to be new designs, who's going to pay for them, who else is going to operate them. The whole thing is unknown. So what Australia is essentially looking for is somebody to guarantee our long-term security. Britain is striving for relevance, which it has so desperately given away by walking away from Brexit, walking away from Europe through the Brexit thing. And isn't it interesting that apart from Boris Johnson, we've heard nothing from Nigel Farage or any of the other great proponents of Brexit, because they can now all see what a disaster it is proving to be for the United Kingdom. So Boris Johnson is simply looking for relevance, and he imagines that he's going to get that relevance by coming back into Asia in a way that that Defence Minister Fox walked away from Asia at the end of the 60s, British Defence Minister Fox, when the East of Suez policy was ditched by the British government. This is quite extraordinary. It's a massive overreach. The United States, it's not quite sure what it wants. It thinks that it wants the pivot, but at the lowest possible cost. And one of the ways of getting the pivot is, I suppose, to latch Australia on even more tightly to itself. We may as well have a 50-second star embroidered on the US flag. So the United States is not quite sure what it wants, but it thinks that what it wants is for Australia to be able to join with it in having a hunter-killer type submarine, which would go after the guaranteed second strike capability of China in the event of a war between China and the United States. This is dystopian thinking at its worst, really, but that is where the United States is sort of taking Australia as a free gift without much care and much consideration handover. I just might make one final point on this, Eben. It's the fact that, as Jeff said, it's an enormous departure in the direction of our foreign policy, which has been evolving now effectively since the Second World War. We've had a very marked reach into Asia since 1945, and that's been more often successful than unsuccessful. But this is a very big departure. But it's also a departure from our standard defence policy, which has been a focus on the direct defence of Australia in the maritime approaches proximate to Australia, for which conventional submarines are actually well suited, to a forward defence policy such as we had 45 years ago, where we would send our defence assets 4,000 kilometres away with all of the logistic and operational support that that would require. And we decided in 1985 that it was too expensive and too risky to have that policy, which is why we came closer to home again. So this AUKUS thing opens up an absolute a total miasma of confusion, with nobody knowing what it's for, what it's based on, what it's supposed to do, or whether it will ever realise what appears to be the principal object of it, which is the nuclear-powered submarine.
More American troops and equipment will be deployed to Australia as part of a new strategic alliance forged with the United States and Britain.
The House will understand how Australia's future possession of this capability will help to safeguard the peace and security of the Indo-Pacific.
China has probably miscalculated and overreacted, and that causes people to realign their views.
In the past, described China as the greatest threat Australia faces.
The threats to Taiwan, the people who've gone off the street, just basically been whipped off the street in Hong Kong. Of course we've got to be mindful of that, and to ignore that is a foolish thing to do.
We do believe it's in Australia's national security interests to deepen our relationship with the United States.
It's how we achieve a free and open Indo-Pacific. And the way you do that is that countries like Australia and India and the United States and Japan, well, we stand up for the values that we believe in.
So a lot of focus initially was understandably around the nuclear submarine announcement, but just going back to read some of the coverage at the time, AUKUS itself as a security pact was described by the BBC as, quote, the country's biggest defence partnership in decades. I've asked Alan this in the past, but in terms of a security or a defence pact, like, does it actually make Australia, the UK or the US any more secure?
No, absolutely not. I mean, there are no obligations. It's not a treaty level. I don't even think there's an MOU. It's not clear, as Alan said, quite what it is, other than as I've described before on the ABC, a headline. It's certainly a headline. It's a head turner, but what are the obligations and the quid pro quos and so on in it? It doesn't. And yet, of course, if it leads, which I think Alan was alluding to forward positioning of US military assets in Australia, it may actually make us less secure. And that, I think, is a key element missing from the public debate. Are we going to have US naval bases? Are we going to have US medium long-range missiles or strategic air command or whatever stationed in Australia. To that extent, we could be finding ourselves under greater threat and less secure.
Mm. Alan, just sticking with, I guess, the nuclear-powered submarines for the moment, AUKUS certainly looks as though it's focused on China. But if we take that little bit, that announcement, or little, I say it's a huge announcement, what chance is there actually that the nuclear-powered submarines will eventuate? Because I hate to agree with Greg Sheridan, but it does appear like all we've done at the moment is cancel a contract for submarines without really anything to replace them at the moment.
That's completely right. I think the chances of having a nuclear-powered submarine delivered in this particular way are practically zero. And I say that because there are so many hurdles that have got to be jumped before we even get to the point of design and construction. There are a whole lot of issues around how nuclear safeguards are going to work with respect to an Australian-owned and operated nuclear reactor over which we have no control, particularly if it is a very long-term reactor which will necessarily be fabricated out of highly enriched uranium. We don't have any of that in Australia. We'll have to know exactly how much we've got, what the densities are, and I would be gobsmacked if either Britain or the United States were to put on any public record exactly the composition of the fuels they're using in their nuclear reactors. So that's the first huge thing that we've got to jump. Secondly, who's going to build it? We don't know. Is it going to be Electric Boat? Is it going to be Boris Johnson? He's promising jobs in the northern parts of Britain. We're promising jobs at Osborne in South Australia. They're not mutually compatible. So we don't know where they're going to be built. We don't know what the boat looks like. And I can have to tell you that I started working as a consultant on this stuff back in 2003, and we've made exactly zero progress in just under 20 years. Now, that's probably a reflection on the quality of my consulting skills, but equally, it shows you something about the deep complexity of the problem that we're dealing with. What kind of capability is best suited to our needs? And if we suddenly think that our needs are best met by a capability that prioritises hunting ballistic missile submarines, because that's what hunter-killer submarines do, then it's an enormous departure in our policy. And so, as Jeff said, this is a headline, or as I would probably put it, this is an answer in search of a question. And until we know what the bloody question is, we have no idea whether this answer is the right one or even if it is achievable.
Mm.
So the whole thing is just a fiasco.
Jeff, you've touched on the fact that Australia's relationship with China is very poor at the moment. Much is being made, not just here, but I guess in the Western media and particularly in the United States at the moment, of China's so-called incursions into Taiwan's self-proclaimed airspace. Just how significant are China's actions here and what are they intended to achieve? And keep in mind, I'm a layperson here. I'm not any kind of expert on anything, and a lot of our listeners will be as well.
Well, again, we need to unpack this. There's the breathless journalistic reporting and sort of general beat up around what's been going on. And then there's what China's intention is. The facts are that, yes, a big number of sorties were flown around before and on National Day, which is celebrated on both sides of the Strait, Taiwan Strait, and they were so-called incursions into Taiwan's air identification defence zone, AIDZ, air defence identification zone, ADIZ. But if you look at that, Taiwan's, which has no legal, by the way, has no legal force, as not recognised by others, Taiwan's zone extends over mainland provinces of China. Zhejiang province, Jiangsu, are all picked up in this zone. So, Fujian. So, I mean, to say they're flying incursions every day when they fly up and down the coast within territorial mainland China. the flights were like 240 kilometres south of Taiwan Island proper, which is a fair way off. But they were numerous and they were conducted to make a point. And there were two points. One, to Taiwan on National Day, just to constantly keep the pressure on Taiwan, to keep the public discussion in Taiwan going about relations with China and the limits to moving towards any formal declaration of independence. But equally, there's a very, very big message for the United States in all of this, that it doesn't matter, you know, how much you hector us, lecture us, tell us to respect Taiwan's autonomy, we will act in our interests, and Taiwan is a core interest of China. So there were some important messages, but the reality is this is going on all the time. What changed on the 1st of October was just the quantum of flights. But, you know, it's extremely unhelpful to have the international community weighing in on these issues when ultimately the resolution of Taiwan-China cross-straits relations will be done by China and Taiwan. So, you know, we had Tony Abbott popping up in Taiwan. You know, I don't know who funded his trip, but I suppose he'll declare himself an agent of influence of Taiwan soon on the register. I mean, who needs Tony Abbott popping up in the middle of this? It was a joke, a stunt, another stunt. And you just wonder what's going on and why these things are happening. But all of it is unhelpful.
Mm.
Well, with tensions rising across the Taiwan Strait and with Australia's relationship with China in a perilous state, this is a time when diplomatic skill is required. Enter Tony Abbott.
Unhelpful is a good word, certainly one that's characterised a lot of the back and forth between China and Australia in terms of efforts to repair the relationship. But sticking with Taiwan just for the moment, Jeff, if Taiwan's democratic character and its need to continue to be separate from China is or has been a means by which the United States keeps China off balance strategically, how do Xi Jinping's recent remarks suggest China might address this new emphasis where democracy is a determinant of Taiwan's future?
Well, I think Xi is interesting. He's come back to an earlier formula which stresses peaceful reunification. A couple of years ago at National People's Congress, would be 2 years ago, that'd make it February 19, I think, or 18, he had a fairly strong closing speech and he omitted the words peaceful reunification, and that sent alarm bells off everywhere and allowed all the alarmists and the hysterical types to start saying there's been a change, fundamental change in Chinese policy, and they're getting ready for military invasion of Taiwan. As I argued in my book last year, there is not a military solution at hand for Beijing. And I think when we discuss Taiwan, we need to begin with that premise. You know, the president of China is not going to have Han Chinese killing Han Chinese on a vast scale. And nor is there any resolution, and the Communist Party of China understands guerrilla warfare very, very well. It's just not going to happen. That's why I say it's important not to over-dramatise the issues, to understand that there's a dance going on both sides of the straits. Yes, I mean, it's important for Taiwan to have its own military capacity. The US will and has to legislatively continue to supply that to Taiwan. But we're not on the precipice of war. And I think all the talk in Australia about war over Taiwan and something is serving another agenda. It's actually not intended to really address the issues of cross-straits tension or indeed enhance Australia's security.
Yeah.
Alan, would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. The issue here is really one for China and Taiwan to work out. It will take a long time yet to settle it, I think. I doubt that it will ever be settled by the use of armed force. And until the United States in particular can see that the way forward here is for eventually a peaceful reunification between Taiwan and China in terms of the agreement that Nixon made back in the early 70s and we also made back in the early 70s, then we will continue to fumble around create the spectre of war unnecessarily and do ourselves a huge amount of diplomatic damage. If we look at how our friends in Asia are actually dealing with this problem, they're dealing with it in the way they've traditionally dealt with such things. They ignore it. And the best advice for us would be to do the same. If the Americans want to keep trying to put China off balance, well, let them try to do it. It's a stupid strategy, actually, because there's too much at stake. But for us, we don't have to be part of that. And our best move is to ignore what's happening in the Taiwan Strait and get on with the business of building a prosperous, peaceful and cooperative Asia, which is really where our security is going to be, not in 8 steel hulls driven by long-term nuclear propulsion.
That's a very good point, Alan. To finish up, Jeff, I might come back to you and ask again. As a former ambassador to China, I mean, Alan and I have spoken quite a lot about the need for Australia to reinvest in diplomacy, and we've talked a lot about the damage to the relationship between Australia and China and diplomacy, and certainly much more effective diplomacy than we've seen thus far as a way forward. What would your advice be for people who are thinking about this, how Australia can repair its relationship with China? And I guess that goes both ways. What can China be doing to improve things as well?
Well, the relationship is in an incredibly bad spot. My feeling is that people here now are of the view that they would like to see the relationship get into a better place, maybe not back to the frothiness that it once had. And that's probably impossible now after what we've been through. But it's better to get on with things, and this is becoming a distraction and it's not serving anyone's interest. So there is, I think, a chance of getting things back on track. It'll come through the economic avenues. And I think, again, the government's fumbled so badly. When China came out and said it wanted to join the rebadged TPP, which is now bad CPTPP, it's a mouthful. So I'll just refer to TPP. China would have known when it put its hand up to join that Australia would say, yeah, we will support you, but a price. And the price is you remove the trade measures you have against us. They wouldn't have asked to join if they hadn't anticipated that. But we have fumbled so badly. We are very unclear whether we support China. We've given no strong, robust linkage between our support for their membership and their removal of measures. And also it runs against what's now becoming just a rhetorical piece of Australian foreign policy, that we support a rules-based system. Now, there are many different rules-based systems, but the TPP is one of those. And at one stage, we were disappointed China wasn't part of it. Though clearly China's playing a game here. It's trying to outmaneuver the US diplomatically, because the US clearly can't, because of domestic politics, come into the TPP or rejoin the TPP, which they left under Trump. But, China gave us an opportunity and we fluffed it. And so, it's your point, Ebony, that we need much more active, skillful diplomacy, but that has to be backed by the Prime Minister in particular. And there's no leadership other than stunts. So I think that's the problem. One other point I'd like to make, Ebony, just quickly before closing, because you can't really think about how we repair our relations with China without looking at US-China relations. And we've had already 2 telephone calls between Xi Jinping and Biden. And note, we've had nothing between Australia and China for 4 years now. You've had 2 senior officials meeting, with one that's just concluded in Zurich. It was very important. And now a Zoom summit is foreshadowed between Xi and Biden. There's a lot of movement going on. And we've had, if you like, quite a constructive statement from the USTR, Tai, and she has formulated another version of relations with China, and she's talking about recoupling, not decoupling. And then you've had the Secretary for Commerce coming out saying, China's an abuser of the system and we have to impose more tariffs. And there's a big debate in the US over the tariffs and whether they should go. The point I'm making is that there's tremendous movement in the US around China policy. And the one thing to note now is that the US doesn't seem to know, or the Biden administration, I should say, does not seem to know what the problem is, what it's trying to deal with, and what it wants. But I would just say, watch this space, because Australia could find itself like a shag on a rock if the US substantially resets its relations with China. And I'll have a couple of dollars on that.
Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. Thank you so much for joining us. This episode was recorded on Tuesday, the 12th of October, 2021, and things may have changed since recording. You can visit australiainstitute.org.au for all our latest research, and we're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. Alan Beam is at Miranda Prorsis. And our producer, Jennifer Macy, is at Jennifer Macy. Our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum, with additional music from Blue Dot Sessions. Stay safe out there, get vaccinated as soon as you can, and thanks for listening.